What's up, everybody? This is John. This week's episode of the 90s podcast, we'll talk about Woodstock 1999, among other gigs and festivals. Due to the graphic nature of discussion, feel free to skip that section of the podcast this week. I've included in the show notes the times in which Woodstock 99 discussion happens, and for our YouTube watchers, I'll stamp that so you can skip ahead at your convenience. And with that out of the way, welcome to the show. What's up, everybody? This week I'm joined by Sarah as we talk about some of the most famous, infamous, and important gigs or festivals of the 1990s, with our Big Gigs and Festivals tribute. That and a whole lot more is to come on this week's episode of the 90s Podcast. Welcome to the show. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to the 90s podcast right here on the Because We Network. Hope you're doing well today, and I'm joined by Sarah. Sarah, how are you?
I'm fabulous. How are you?
I'm doing good. Now, if you listened last week, you notice I did this bit with my eyes closed. I have not blinked once since I started talking.
Are your eyes burning?
Just a little bit. Right. It has been a wonderful, wonderful week. How have you spent it?
Sleep. Well, trying to sleep. Failing to sleep. I'm out of sleep medicine. So,
You've been better.
I've been awake.
Okay. Yeah, it has been a week. It has been a very, very long and prosperous week for us here.
It's been 1 week since you talked to me.
She's in a good mood tonight, everybody. I'm in a good mood, too. We just spent the last hour educating our children on the greatness or lameness, depending on which side of the fence you sit on. There's no... You either love them or you hate them.
Limp Bizkit. Yes.
Because they never hear them.
No.
They never hear any of the songs. They... Nothing.
And it is all about the he said, she said BS.
Yes, it is. So... but we'll get to why we were talking about Limp Bizkit here in a little while. Because it does tie into our recording tonight.
Very much so.
Yes. So, Sarah, why are we here today?
We are here... on this very, very special day.
Year of our Lord, 2024.
In the era of Al Gore's internet.
Yes.
Or Beyonce's internet, depending on who you listen to. To discuss another era. The 1990s era of big gigs and festivals.
Yes. So what I did is for my research, so that people don't get angry that I didn't talk about this or that or the other. Mm-hmm. Is I reached out and wrote down a list of what I thought were the 9 most important gigs, festivals, shows that existed in the 90s from both sides of the old ocean. So there's some British stuff in here and there's some American stuff in here. And there's actually one that is a hybrid of the both, which we'll get to here in a few minutes. I know, right? See, I can do proper research. but... We're talking about some of these because of the importance that they had during the 90s and the aftermaths and what they symbolized to the greater audiences and even the fellow musicians at the time.
Right.
So we've got 9 to go through. That sounds like a lot, but we'll get through them and we'll voice our opinions and such like that. But the first thing we're going to talk about is, drum roll please. Stone Roses.
Awesome.
Spike Island gig, 1990.
10 Story Love Song.
Yes. This was their first album that didn't have 10 Story Love Song on it. The 10 Story Love Song was on Second Coming.
I know.
See, I know that much. No, Spike Island gig. Okay, the Stone Roses were the biggest band in the UK from 1989 to about 1991. Right, they had major hits. Made of Stone, She Bangs the Drums, I Want to Be Adored, Fool's Gold.
Right,
they were successes not just in the UK, but they were starting to get like a little bit of traction over in America. So you know, it was unusual at that time for British music to get radio play in the United States.
A little bit, yes.
Especially on the alternative scene, because the alternative scene in the late 80s, early 90s in America was off the chart.
Right.
You know, you couldn't say anything at it. So they announced their British tour, and they booked a place called Spike Island. The gig was supposed to take place on May 27th of 1990.
Okay.
Now, why is this gig important? because according to all attendees,
right,
it was nothing great. It was just a gig. They had sound issues. It mm-hmm. was raining. Mm-hmm. But why are we talking about it? Because the Spike Island gig is one of the most significant gigs in British music history. Because the mid-90s music scene showed up to that show as fans.
Yeah.
And then they were either inspired to start a band
mm-hmm.
or inspired to work with bands.
Right.
Or, you know, right. You had, for example, Johnny Marr,
mm-hmm.
legendary guitarist of the Smiths.
Yep.
He was just there as a fan.
Mm-hmm.
The guys from Oasis, they showed up
yep.
separately,
mm-hmm.
it might be said. Even though they knew each other, they all showed up separately.
Right.
They were there. Band called The Real People, who they were there. Jarvis was there.
Ah, so the Common People arrived.
Common People arrived, yes. Yeah. I didn't confirm this, but I think the guy from Suede were there as well.
Fabulous.
So everybody who started that mid-90s Britpop movement
was at
Spike Island. It did leave a stamp on the British music scene. I mean, a lot of people become megastars and say mm-hmm. this is where it started. Because after this, for example, let's use Oasis as an example. After the show, Tony McCarroll, Paul Arthurs, and Paul McGuigan got together
yeah.
and started a band called The Rain.
Yes.
The Rain was pre-Oasis.
Right.
Because what happened is they kicked the lead singer out because he... In the book, Getting High by Pablo Hewitt, they mm-hmm. said that he kicked the original singer out because they were doing the Trog's Wild Thing. And Gwigsy, the bass player, got offended that he was singing Wild Thing, Smoke a Draw, and this dude had never smoked anything in his life. And that mildly offended the mild-mannered...
So because he was singing about pot
and not partaking in it, he had to go, and they replaced him
He
was a hypocrite. So they replaced him with their friend Noel's little brother.
Yeah.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
And Noel history, it's Nibworth.
There you go. See? We'll get to that here in a few minutes. Noel Gallagher met a guy called Mark Coyle, and they started offering their services to bands and ended up roadieing for the Inspiral Carpets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was seen as the starting point of the revival of the British rock music scene.
Right.
Because it was stale after the mid-80s, you know.
Right.
I mean, the Jam had broken up. The Smiths weren't really rock. They were something.
Right.
And they were good, but right. they weren't necessarily rock.
Right.
You know. And the Roses, well, what happened to the Stone Roses? Because we talk about the Britpop scene and we never talk about the Stone Roses.
Ian Brown started stirring tea at the Leaky Cauldron.
Yes. If you watch Harry Potter, in the third movie, the guy's stirring tea.
With his finger.
Apparently, he's been voted the strongest wizard in the Harry Potter universe because he's doing magic without a wand.
Yes.
So,
wandless, yes.
So, there you go. It's a hard one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened to the Stone Roses is they finished the tour and they wanted to do their second album.
Yes.
But the record label got involved. And they had a major, major lawsuit that lasted 5 years. So instead of releasing a follow-up in 92, maybe 93 at the latest,
right.
they were out of it until 95.
And that was a bit... It was a whole different scene then.
It was a whole different scene. And people had forgotten who the Roses were. I mean, not forgotten, but, you know, it was...
The fan base had moved on.
Yes, because then you had the Britpop scene and right. the shoegaze scene.
Yeah.
You know, and everything like that. Because, like I said, by the time they got back, it was Suede, Pulp, Blur, Oasis, The Verve.
Right.
You know, and...
But...
One of my favorite named band, Ned's Atomic Dustbin.
Yes. Yes.
Now, they weren't huge, but I just wanted to say that live.
Right.
So, but this was an important show, especially in the psyche of the British rock music scene.
Well, that and 90% of... Britpop frontmen also owed Ian Brown their haircut.
Oh, yeah. The haircut and the swagger.
Yes. Because that whole arms to the side, leaning up to the microphone.
Snarling into it.
Yeah, with the shaggy, like, I had my haircut 8 months ago, but I can't.
Bear to cut it.
Yeah.
My hair, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My
hair, at least your hair when we met.
My hairstyle hasn't changed that much over the years. Now I'm being made to cut it every couple of months.
Well, I mean, Yeah.
Although there was a point where I didn't cut my hair for 2 years and I had the Jesus look.
Yeah, that was kind of...
Yeah. I liked it, anyway.
Okay, so next we had... Now, in case you're wondering, my input on the first couple of these is anecdotal, but I'm going to talk more here in just a minute. So,
jump forward a couple of years. Now, these are going in chronological order.
Yes. So the next one is the Freddie Mercury tribute concert for AIDS awareness in 92.
Yeah, we know the story of Freddie Mercury, and it's a tragic one after about 1989.
Yeah.
Freddie Mercury was the legendary voice of God.
Yes.
Basically. Yes. I had the voice of a god, I should say.
Right.
I think I've said this before. They asked why Brian May didn't sing many Queen songs, because he has the voice of an angel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Freddie had the voice of a god. So,
right.
You know.
So, but Freddie died actually in 91 of complications with AIDS, less than 24 hours after announcing publicly that he had had the illness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the next year at the 92 Brit Awards, Queen announced this show, this benefit tribute concert, and that it would take place at Wembley Stadium.
Yeah, I think when it comes to certain bands have a certain, you know, there's always one location that you associate with the band. Like Beatles is Abbey Road, you know. So with Queen, it was Wembley Stadium.
Right.
Because they had like three nights there in 87. And they did the Live Aid from there, where they completely and utterly stole the show. So Wembley would have been the best place. The only other place that they could have done it, really, would have been either Twickenham Stadium or Nebworth Park.
Yeah.
To get that many people involved.
Yeah. So, but apparently tickets sold out in 3 hours.
Now, this is 92. There was no Ticketmaster. You had to actually call a number and give them a credit card. And
yeah, I tried to explain to the kids that the other day how, like, tickets for Swift would have worked back in the day. Like, people would have had to have gone to the venue and camped for weeks at a time. Yeah. Well, no, you'd have some that would get there like 2 weeks ahead of time. I mean, especially for something that big.
Taylor Swift, yeah.
Yeah, or something for this big, too. So, yeah, and it's like trying to call up, which we'll talk about that later if you put that in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, anyway.
So the show was like a tribute to the life of Freddie, as well as, you know, tipped segments for bringing awareness to AIDS. Because even this early on, people believed you could catch AIDS by handshakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Which, yeah.
Which is stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know better.
Right.
And I'm not saying that they were right, but I mean, even then you knew you couldn't catch the disease by handshake. It was just an excuse for, you know, for hate. But the gig set up like a festival. There were kind of two parts to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there were eight acts who showed up who played nothing but their own music.
Right.
So you had Metallica, Extreme, Def Leppard, Bob Geldof, Spinal Tap, and Guns N' Roses. They played their show at Wembley.
Jesus.
There was an Extreme, the band. They actually did a cover. They did basically a whole medley of Queen songs. So think Weird Al Yankovic's Poker, but nothing but Queen songs.
Right.
So it was really, really good. Mango Groove and U2 didn't play at Wembley. They played via satellite.
Right.
And Bono being Bono didn't have time to show up on the day, so they recorded.
Of course he did.
Their set, pre-recorded, and then beamed it in via satellite.
Right.
Yeah. Bloody hell. Mm-hmm. The rest of the show was Queen with a guest singer for a track or two. So, like, they'd have someone come out, sing a song.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, I was going to say, this is the one where we got the first rendition of George Michael's version of Somebody to Love, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
That stole the show.
Oh, well, yeah.
I mean, it was the absolute highlight, because a lot of people tried to live up to Freddie and tried to sing it, you know, the way he would. Whereas George Michael went out there and sung it as George Michael.
Which is how you should do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
because you can't be Freddie.
No, you can't be Freddie.
I mean, Adam, what's his face, is close.
Adam Lambert. Yeah.
He's, I mean, he's not Freddie at all.
No.
He'll not be Freddie. But if there was ever someone who was pitch-wise similar.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing too, right? Some of the guest singers included David Bowie, Elton John, Robert Plant, Roger Daltrey, James Hetfield, Paul Young, Seal, and Lisa Stansfield.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was a heck of a show. Sold out, Wembley Stadium, 90,000 people in that pit of a stadium. I went to that stadium the first time in 94,
mm-hmm.
and it was a dump then. So I can imagine how much of a dump it was in 92, excuse me.
Yeah.
So, Metallica and Def Leppard's performance were mixed and releases B-sides and special mini EPs for their bands to show their work.
Mm-hmm.
And Bowie did the same thing with their version of All the Young Dudes. Because they weren't just singing Queen songs.
Yeah.
They were singing, you know, Queen was like the house band for the day.
Right.
For lack of a better
term. Well, yeah, it's like the Taylor Hawkins tribute.
Yeah.
You know, where the Fighters of Foo were the background for the different folks.
Foo Fighters.
Yeah. I don't know why. But I guess that's why that's in my head, is because you have been walking around.
It's because I've been doing the research.
Last 3 days, people. Well, I have been walking around. Do you know how disconcerting it is when you round the corner and your husband is just sitting at his desk working, not talking to anybody. He's not listening to anything.
I am listening to stuff. That's where it comes most out.
But all of a sudden, like, you're walking by and you say, "Foo Fighters." Like, he's freaking Christopher Walken.
Well, that's the joke.
I know. Or, like, you walk in and he's cooking and, like, flipping chicken in the pan, Foo Fighters. I'm like, what the hell?
That's the ADHD, though. It makes me...
Hyperfixation. Yes. I know.
There was a TikTok that I hyperfixated on for 4 days. And it stuck in my head for 4 days. And I'm not going to repeat it because it's going to get back in my head again. But it just... The whole time, I'm just humming this little ditty.
I've been doing that, too, with the...
Yeah, right? So, I mean, back to Queen. Yes. I mean, this is considered probably the best tribute concert in the history of music.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wrote the research to this one before the Taylor Hawkins show, and that was considered one of the best tributes, too, also at Wembley Stadium.
Mm.
A lot of parallels.
I tell you, the British music scene is incestuous.
Probably.
No, and I don't mean that, you know what, but I mean is everybody knows everybody. Yeah. Everybody's dated each other, or the people have run around in the same circles.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. But then again, when you have to realize, and it's weird as an American, but like the whole place can fit in Texas.
Oh, the whole place, England can fit in Louisiana.
Right, but you know what I'm saying. So it's hard for me to wrap my brain around, but it's like, yeah, there's only so much land. Where are they spreading out to?
Right.
I mean,
they all worked with each other, against each other, or, you know, they worked with somebody who worked with somebody who eventually hooked up together.
Right.
That's how it was. I mean, the Queen's 50th Jubilee concert,
mm-hmm.
like they had Phil Collins and Roger Taylor on drums.
Yeah.
And then they had Paul McCartney come in, and then they had, you know, just...
Yeah, it's crazy.
And they played together. They didn't have to rehearse as much.
No, because everybody knew everybody.
Yeah. So Queen would continue to make sporadic appearances as a three-piece over the next couple of years, and then as a two-piece with arrangements with Adam Lambert, as we mentioned, and Paul Rodgers. And they'd go by the name... They wouldn't call it Queen. They'd call it Queen plus
whoever,
Adam Lambert, Paul Rodgers, you know, whoever. Because bassist John Deacon basically said that after Freddie died, he was retired.
Right.
I mean, there was nothing more he could do about it. And I guess he fell into the same trap as REM drummer Bill Berry.
Yeah.
Who thought that, well, if I've retired, the rest of the band retired. No,
not so much.
They carried on.
No.
So, yeah.
I mean, Brian May is... still going around making music, discovering planets, you know, as one does. Yeah. I think the whole world went, ooh?
When they found out he was an astrophysicist.
Yeah, right? It's like, with that hair?
We should address him by his official title, Dr. May.
Is it Sir Dr. May?
No, not...
No, is he a sir?
I don't know. I don't have my phone on me to check. And I'm monitoring the recording on the computer, so I can't.
Okay.
We'll find that out at a later date.
Yes.
Anyway, so, next thing on our list is, we're staying in 1992 for a minute.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about the Reading Festival.
Okay.
The Reading Festival of 1992. Now, the Reading Festival was originally known as the National Jazz Band and Blues Festival.
I would like to pause you real quick. It is Sir Dr. May.
It is Sir Dr. May? Okay.
Yes. Sir, he wanted May. It all, and he got it now.
That's right.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry.
So we're in Reading.
We're in Reading. Now, this is before they added the Leeds portion of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they did with this festival is they improved it, I think, in the year 2002 or 1999, one of the two. They added another location up north, but with the same bill.
Okay.
So, like, if you headlined Reading on Friday, you'd headline Leeds on Saturday.
Okay.
And so on and so forth. But at this point, it was just in Reading in the UK. Reading's a small little town about 20 miles outside of London.
Okay.
20 miles east of London. No, west of London, excuse me. So it's, you have to drive through it to get to my hometown if you're leaving to go to London on the main road over there.
All right.
But the 70s saw the festival have a permanent home in Reading in the UK. And it was expanded to include prog rock, metal, and the punk bands of the day. Because in the 70s, it wasn't just rock. They were, you know, they were experimenting with rock.
All right.
That's where metal was invented and prog rock and you know, stuff like that. So, but the early 90s, the Reading Festival had a low popularity with the fans. So, you know, it didn't have... It wasn't as popular as it is today, for example. Okay? So, the festival managed to get Nirvana in.
Fabulous.
And this is why we're talking about it. Because we're talking about Nirvana live at the Reading Festival in 1992.
Right.
So Nirvana headlined day three of the festival. So they were closing the whole kit and caboodle out. Day one through three had some of the biggest bands at the time, not just in the UK, but in the world. And what I mean by that is that the Wonder Stuff, who were a UK band, headlined night one.
Right.
And the Public Enemy headlined night two.
Okay.
The festival also had some of the biggest British bands of the day and some of the British American bands of the day. So you had the Manic Street Preachers, Ride, you had Nick Cave, the Charlatans, PJ Harvey, and Smashing Pumpkins, too.
So, fabulous.
So Billy Corgan with hair. He looks weird with hair. He really does.
Yes, he does. Because it's very curly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with all those bands, you know, including Billy Corgan's hair, the popularity of the festival kind of perked up again. You know, it was seen as, you know, an alternative to what Glastonbury was. The band, Nirvana, showed up and played 25 songs.
Jesus.
They stayed up well past the curfew.
Right.
And but it was Nirvana. They didn't care.
No, Nirvana doesn't give a crap.
And it was in Britain. So, you know, what were they going to do?
Send them home for free?
Yeah. I mean, you know, what, first class? Calgon, right. Take me away.
Right.
You know, they included three unreleased tracks at the time of performance. So this is pre-In Utero Nirvana.
Right.
So I'm guessing those three would have been All Apologies.
Right.
Hardship Box and something else.
Probably, yeah.
You know, the funny thing is, Nirvana got their own way with everything at this festival.
Of course they did.
They handpicked the lineup of the final day. Mm-hmm. Because, quote, they didn't want any lame-ass limey bands to lead into them. So what happened to the show itself?
Yeah, wasn't this one the one that, if I remember correctly, there had been rumors that Kurt was... Somebody had OD'd. Somebody had... Yeah. And so... he was wheelchaired onto the stage by a, you know, quote unquote doctor wearing a medical gown. He was wearing the medical gown. He got out of his chair, quote, passed out, quote unquote, on the ground and stayed motionless for a few seconds.
Fans were like wondering what the heck was going on.
Right. And then he got up and slated.
Yeah. He basically wanted to say fuck you to the reporters who were saying that his mental health was all over the place.
Right.
Which it was.
That's not their business.
But it's not their business.
Right.
And he's, you know, whatever. There were 9 gigs that Nirvana had a guy called Dancing Tony. And this was the last of the shows that he did it. He was only there for half the show because the show lasted like 6 hours with all the music that they played, the 25 songs.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, this was Nirvana at their peak.
Right.
Especially in Europe. This right here, they performed... The performance will be released in 2009 on CD and DVD. And the band and the critics hailed this as like a masterpiece.
Right.
So the festival was real, real good. But the cherry on top was this Nirvana performance. And Nirvana were proud of it, too.
Well, yeah.
Not just because of the way it came out, but because of how much rehearsal time they had in between. Because they'd done the Nevermind tour.
Yeah.
This was like, you know, a special, we're recording in utero, we're going to play this
gig.
They
were a little busy.
They were a little busy. Yeah. And they didn't have much time to rehearse.
Mm-mm. Yeah. And 92, that's, wasn't that, or Francis was born in 92 as well, if I remember
correctly.
I think so. Yeah. So,
I don't know, that's a Courtney Love question.
Yes.
And you're more Courtney than I am.
Yeah, because, well, he passed in 94, and she was 2 when he passed. So, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, she was born at some point in 92. Yeah.
Oh, to be a fly on the wall and Smashing Pumpkins in Nirvana dressing room.
Okay, now. Now we're stepping into my wheelhouse.
Yes, we're traveling across the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And Sarah?
Yes.
How would you like some peace and love?
Okay, I would love peace and love. So here's the thing. I was a little baby hippie back in the day. My mom used to say that I was born out of my time warp. And one of the things that I was obsessed with was the old 60s festivals like Monterey Pop and Woodstock and all that good stuff, right? So I remember when they announced Woodstock 94, and I mean, I was 13. I was not going to get to go. It was not, no. Mm-mm. But I wanted to go so bad. But Woodstock 94 was the 25th anniversary of the original Woodstock Festival. I remember watching it on MTV. It took place on the same weekend, 25 years later, on the 12th to 14th of August of 94. It was originally titled Two More Days of Peace and Music, and a third day was added due to demand, right?
New tomato.
Right. And well, right. But that kind of worked out because the original Woodstock was also 3 days. So, now, they ended up, it wasn't on the same farm that the original one was. They ended up having to go up north.
No, because they needed logistically.
Right, they needed more space. Because a lot of things had happened since then. For one, more people had cars. For two, the cars were bigger. For three, this was not just something that was kind of word of mouth or, you know, the counterculture set. Like, this was being heavily promoted. So there were huge crowds coming. Not only the nostalgic, let's revisit where we met a million years ago, but also let's, you know, a new kid, you know, newer kids wanting to hop in on it.
I got you. Right.
Yeah. So you had, it was a very mixed bag as far as who played it. Okay. So you had the contemporary at the time artists like Sheryl Crow, Green Day, Nine Inch Nails, Metallica, Aerosmith, Blind Melon, The Cranberries, Red Hot Chili Peppers. Originally, I think when they were doing the talks for at the beginning of the year, if my pop culture memory may be failing me, I know at one point in time, because things like this aren't put together in a month. Like, it's,
no,
it's done like
about
a
6 year,
months,
well,
even
year.
A year. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if I remember correctly, Nirvana had been initially approached and Kurt was like, nah, he wasn't. Yeah.
He wasn't feeling the love.
Right. But even then, of course, he passed before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sadly.
So, yes. So, the weather on the Friday was perfect.
Well, hang on. Wasn't just
oh, well, that's right.
Acts.
Sorry.
We had
you're right.
Older acts.
Older acts like Santana, Peter Gabriel, Bob Dylan, Joe Cocker, Crosby, Stills and Nash, The Band, Jefferson Airplane.
Yep.
Grace Slick brought, either she brought her original outfit or her daughter wore her original outfit there.
Sometime.
I don't know, something like that. Anyway.
And Peter Gabriel was the headline act of the festival. Let me stop you right there. 1994, Peter Gabriel is headlining.
Totally different than OG Peter Gabriel.
I mean, I just.
Yeah.
Everybody knows, not my disdain, but my okay. I don't dislike Phil Collins. I joke that I do
right.
a lot of the time.
Right.
But I'm not a big fan of Genesis.
Right.
Especially Peter Gabriel Genesis.
Right.
I mean, and this is Sledgehammer or Peter Gabriel.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah.
To put them above, say, Green Day or even Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Dylan should have headlined the event.
Maybe. Yeah. But the weather on Friday was, like I said, was great. However, the rains came in on Saturday, saturating the ground and making the field into mud pits, which was kind of reminiscent. Like, it had the same vibe because there was a lot of rain and mud in the OG Woodstock. Now, bear all this. Take note, kid, and take note, kids. This will come back up later.
Yes.
All right, so several of the bands got into the mud pits and or played in the mud before their performances because there was also mud in the backstage area, too.
Yeah.
So a lot of bands came on stage after having been, like, dancing and moshing with each other backstage when other bands were on stage.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So most particularly, Green Day, Nine Inch Nails showed up looking like the mud creatures.
Yes. The creatures from the Mud Lagoon, yes. And then you had... Blind Melon Shannon Hoon appeared to be strung out on hallucinogenic drugs during his set and during the interviews afterward. So
MTV had rights to cover this.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's another thing to take note for later.
Well, before we go on to that,
yes.
I mean, the mud pits, the mud fights and everything were, you know, were fun and everything like that. But don't talk to Mike Dirnt about the mud pits.
No.
Because he was injured because security started to beat the shnikes out of him because they thought he was a fan that jumped up on stage and not the bassist of one of the bigger bands at the festival.
Not the bassist of Green Day. Yeah.
So, sorry about that.
No, you're good. You're good. You're good. All right. So, here's the thing. Picture it. Woodstock, 1994. All right. The same people, the same dude over the OG Woodstock was over this one. And apparently he went from peace, love, and music to music, capitalism, give me some money. Because a lot of things had changed in the 25 years.
Yeah.
So there were no outside...
No doubt, love.
Right? there was no outside food or drink allowed at the festival.
Yeah.
This became unenforceable, however, after thousands of people were able to enter by climbing and destroying the chain link fences designed to keep the fans in, which is ironic because the same thing happened at the OG Woodstock.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, 350,000 people showed up for this festival and only 160,000 of them had legal tickets.
Yeah.
So
over 200,000 people illegally entered, as well as people leaving and coming back in. Security had a hard time keeping up with things.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, a concert the size of that, where you got people hopping the fence and people leaving and coming back, it's going to create a logistical nightmare.
Right. Right. Now, some other tidbits. Aerosmith's Joey Kramer, Joe Perry, and Steven Tyler were attendees of the original Woodstock.
Oh,
they
yeah.
didn't play it, but they were there.
Yeah.
The tickets for the 94 Woodstock, now this is in $94, okay, were $135 a piece.
Oh, yeah, peace, love, and money. The almighty dollar.
Right. So there was a high medical toll for the festival of this size, as 5,000 people were treated on site, with 800 of those taken to local hospitals, and sadly, 3 of those people died.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan famously did not play at the original Woodstock Festival and was treated like a hero when he started his set.
Yeah, that's why I think he should have paused it up, because he was invited to the first festival and couldn't do it and didn't do it and did the Isle of Wight Festival in the UK instead with an electric guitar. Now, that sounds weird, but the Isle of Wight Festival is a folk festival. He showed up with an electric... You know.
That's when Dylan went electric and people lost their freaking minds.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, later on, Green Day released their set as a live album.
Yes.
And the financial success of the show led to a planned 30th anniversary show, which happened in 99.
Oh, yes.
Again, we, as I said, take notes. We'll be back. So the festival had a highlight VHS and Laserdisc release, as well as a double album.
Yes. So... Woodstock 94 was the kind of the hors d'oeuvre to the poop storm that would become Woodstock 99, which we will get to.
Mm-hmm.
Trust me. That's on the list of things that we want to talk about. But we're going in chronological order,
right.
Not alphabetical order.
Right. So now we've gotten to 1995 and we're jetting back across the pond.
So talk about Glastonbury 1995. Glastonbury 95 took place in the middle of the explosion of... kind of what would become the Britpop movement.
Right.
So you had, you know, this one also was an anniversary show.
Mm-hmm.
The first Glastonbury showed up in 1970. The 95 Festival was the 25th anniversary show. Tickets, £65.
For a whole festival? For, that's not bad.
For
a
3-day festival.
Yeah, it's not bad.
But this is 1995 money. So yeah, it'd probably be around about 150 today.
Yeah.
So, but still worth it, you know? Yeah. And also, this year they decided to televise it for the second year in a row. So, the, and ever since 1994, it's been televised on the BBC. And with new technology, you can actually hit like a button on the BBC on the BBC app on TV, and it's called the red button for those in America. Because we had a thing called teletext where you had red, green, yellow, and blue buttons to navigate. But you hit the red button and you can watch Glastonbury the whole thing.
Very cool.
So it's very cool. So the headline and acts this year were Oasis, the Stone Roses, and the Cure.
Hey.
However, John Squire, Stone Roses guitarist, very underrated guitarist.
Yes.
From those who don't know, he injured his leg.
Oh no!
About a week before, and they pulled out.
Oh no!
So who did they call up in his place? Pulp.
Jarvis.
They pulled up Jarvis, and that was a great replacement because only one of three bands could have done the replacement, I think, and Pulp was one of them.
Yeah.
So what happened in the first two nights? Pulp and the Cure, oh my god, on top of their game, they went out there, the crowd wanted more.
As the kids today would say, they left no crumbs.
No, it slapped.
Yes.
For real.
Mm-hmm.
For life.
No cap.
The Oasis set, however, was marred with sound issues. See, their sound engineer, Mark Coyle, was going deaf. After years of being around the band and everything like that, he was starting to lose his hearing. And not only that, the Cure and Pulp played like a greatest hits, you know, their most recent album.
Right.
Oasis were in between albums. So they played eight songs that either had just been released or the crowd had never heard before.
Oh, well, that's not... I mean, how's it... crowd gonna get in the groove and jump around when they don't know what they're jumping to?
Yeah, this was, you know, this was when Oasis could say, hey, here's Wonderwall, and the fans would go, huh?
Who?
In the words of Travis, what's a Wonderwall anyway?
Right.
You know, and the thing is about Oasis at Glastonbury, they never had a good set. They had three shows at Glastonbury. One was like, you know, as they were coming up,
right,
and it was all right.
Right.
This show was bad. And then the headline slot in 2004 was, I mean, was probably the worst headlining set in the history of Glastonbury, which is odd for a band who pride themselves on their live shows. You know, but also 1995, the reason we're talking about this is they introduced the dance tent to the festival.
Ooh!
So instead of just like a rock and right. pop festival, they moved into dance. And dance music in the UK was starting to grow at this point. You know, so you had Massive Attack, System 7, and Eat Static were the kind of the headliners in the dance tent.
Fabulous.
And the Trainspotters loved it.
I bet.
They really did. This gig took in 400 grand of charitable donations, with 200 grand for Greenpeace, 100 grand for Oxfam, and 100 grand for the local charities.
That did not happen at our festivals.
No. Well, that's one of the things about Glastonbury, too. They right. basically have a bucket that goes around, and you fill the bucket, you know, with your change and everything like that. The perimeter of the fence of the farm, however, was ripped down, so people were entering the festival nearby, and the local farms, because Glastonbury takes place in an actual farm. I'm not sure what the farm does in its day-to-day operations.
I think a family farm.
I think it's a creamery.
Yeah.
So, you know, milk farm, for lack of a better term.
I wonder if the hoof GP goes there.
Maybe.
Graham. I love Graham. Okay, sorry.
That's fine. And of course, because this was the 25th anniversary, they managed to book the two headlining acts from the original festival, Al Stewart and Keith Christmas, and they showed up to do their thing.
Very cool.
So, you know, Glastonbury is UK's biggest music festival. It's held every year in July, and sometimes they'll do like four festivals every 5 years.
Yeah.
Except during the pandemic where they shut down for, you know, a couple of years.
They had to, yeah.
I mean, everybody had to shut down, really, didn't they?
Right.
You know. But we're staying in the UK, and we're talking about the biggest gigs in UK music history.
At the time. It's not history.
It's Nebworth.
It's Nebworth.
It's Oasis at Nebworth Park. So, I know we talk about them a lot. Let's go to their background real quick, and we'll get to where they ended up.
Okay.
Because here's the thing. In 1993, they were playing in front of 120 people in London bars. Mm-hmm. And by 1995, they were selling out stadiums.
Heck yeah. And with all that, they were riding high on their albums, What's the Story, Morning Glory, because it had sold close to 13 million copies. And it would go on to eventually sell over 25 million copies. And this is long before Spotify and iTunes and all that good stuff. So I don't even think LimeWire was quite there yet. Or
WinMX was, though.
And so was Napster. Yeah. We need to do a Napster episode one day.
Yeah, we do.
Okay. So, back to business. The band had announced that they would play a series of massive outdoor gigs in Loch Lomond.
Yep. I can't pronounce the Irish one. I'm sorry.
A one in Ireland.
Yes.
And Nebworth. Sorry, guys. Loch Lomond and the Irish show would hold up to 40,000 people for each show, while Nebworth would hold up to 125,000 people at each for their shows. Tickets for all six gigs sold out within the day of release. There's actually a really cool documentary about this one. About people like on the phones trying to get in. Over 2 million people applied for tickets to these shows. In the end, the band played two nights at Nebworth, playing over 250,000 people.
Okay, it's pronounced Parc y Cyhyd.
Parc y Cyhyd?
Yes.
Okay,
it's,
cool.
It's a stadium in Cork Island that hosts Gaelic games.
Cork. Okay, we'll just say Cork. Because I think I would be more disrespectful butchering it over and over again than just calling it the stadium in Cork. So my apologies.
Yeah, and no offense is intended. We just...
My southern tongue can't do it.
And I'll be completely honest, my Irishness... Because my dad's Irish, it's
diluted because he's been here. Because
my dad's been here for 60 years. So,
yeah. Okay. So, now, all right, getting to the gig, right? All the tickets are bought. People are ready. Let's do the gig.
Yeah.
So the band played a set list containing some of their biggest songs at the time. They played a 20-track set, which was unusual for Oasis. Well, for Oasis. Who usually did about 17, you know, at the time. They debuted two new songs at the show, It's Getting Better Man and My Big Mouth.
If you listen carefully, they're probably still singing It's Getting Better Man.
No, if you listen carefully, they're still singing All Around the World Reprise.
All right.
But the gig was a fantastic show for the band and a huge critical and commercial success.
Yeah, I mean, this was like... This was a vanity show.
Mm-hmm. This is the one because we can.
Yeah. I mean, the other two, they were, you know, the Loch Lomond and the Cork gig, you know, they were big shows. They had Main Road before that, which was the home of Manchester City Football Club for newer fans of the team, who've been fans since they moved stadiums, you know.
This one was a pecker measuring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you know they were held in high esteem with like three or four other bands, and now they were out on their own.
Yes,
because like the VIP set for this show was bigger than arenas that Blur were getting attendances in.
Jesus,
7,000 people, which is phenomenal.
Yes,
coming VIP 7,000. You know,
right?
How many important people are there for their 7,000 of you?
Well, there were still more common people.
Yes,
out in the field. Yes,
it was a gig, but it was referred to as a festival because some of the bands that they had play in there. They had the Prodigy,
right?
Cast, the Charlatans again, the Manic Street Preachers again, and of course everybody's favorite tribute act,
the Bootleg Beatles,
which is ironic because. That's what everybody called Oasis was a cheap bootleg Beatles band, and that's one of the reasons they hired the Bootleg Beatles was again another thumb your nose up to everybody.
Right.
How much were the tickets?
£22.50.
So, £22.50 times 125,000
times two.
Times two. And that is...
And that is how the record label was able to afford to give Noel the Rolls Royce.
Yes. 22 times 250,000. Mm-hmm. The gigs made $5.5 million each. $5.5 million between them.
Yeah, so that...
So you take away the advertising and maybe $4 million.
Well, yeah, and then you had to pay for... I mean, basically, there is at least a couple million a night profit.
Yeah.
Yeah, easy. I mean, but because you had to pay for the rigging and the security and the this and the that and the this and
the support acts.
Right, all that good stuff, yeah. And the vendors and the... So, by the time all that was said and done, I mean, and plus... The police, they had to pay for the...
Yeah.
Yeah, and plus it was on public land, so they had to pay fees and...
No, it was on private land.
It's Nebworth Park is private?
Yes. It's a giant estate in Hertfordshire. Huh. It's actually somewhere where the royals would hang out. It's posh area. You know, very, very aristocratical.
Oh, yeah, they paid. So, yeah. So, but... Looking back at this, this is seen as peak Oasis.
Yeah, the band said in interviews they regret not calling it a day for that period after the shows. Like, instead of, you know, carrying on and doing the Unplugged show and then the American tour, if they'd have just stopped, taken a breather, and carried on working, they would have done better on their third album, they believe.
But then I wouldn't have seen them in 98.
No, you would have seen them in 98. I'm talking about the two they did in 96.
Oh, the one where that... Well, yeah, no. I still wouldn't have seen them when I did. Okay, here's the thing. How everything is related, okay? This is not a 9/11 to Twilight thing. This is... Okay, so the 96 tour, Noel quit midway.
Yeah.
All right, which is how we got Talk Tonight.
No, that was the tour before that. Talk Tonight came out in 94.
You're right. Okay, stop. Anyway... He quit, left. All right. Then when they announced the Be Here Now tour, I had to go.
Yeah.
And because the last tour ended prematurely, I had to go as early as I could possibly get there.
Just in case.
Just in case. Because if not, who knows?
Yeah.
And to make a long story short, Reginald Dwight of... Family Matters and Die Hard fame inadvertently gave me my spending money to go see Oasis in Fairfax, Virginia from Louisiana, because that's how life is funny that way.
Yes.
That's another story for another day.
For another day.
Yeah. But anyway.
But what I'm talking about is if they'd stopped the tour at the end of this show and taken a year off, the Be Here Now album would have been quote unquote better.
Possibly.
And they might have had something more to say and all that stuff. The gig was subject to a documentary called Nebworth. It was on Netflix. I'm not sure if it is anymore. We'll have to check it out. Several members of the band and the fans who were there talk about their experiences.
Right.
And that was my favorite part, listening to the guys from Wales who took a 4-hour drive in a car that shouldn't have done that drive.
Right.
You know, and just stuff like that. Like, they were 10 minutes down the road and they already had to fill the radiator full with water again. You know. We mentioned the band would cool down. In his solo career, Liam Gallagher went back to Nebworth to do a couple of nights and just to show that he still had it. And I think that was more of his own fears.
Right.
And apparently the shows were
phenomenal.
Phenomenal. So
very cool.
So did you take your notes? We're going to jump forward a couple of years.
We're jumping forward a couple of years, but we're jumping back in location.
Yes.
Because now it's Woodstock 99. I wanted to go to this so bad. I wanted to go so bad. But because I had done my little jaunt across the country prior to go see Oasis in 98. And then when I also went to go see U2 on Pop Mart. That it was not in the cards or the budget, but I wanted to go so bad. But sometimes God has your back.
In hindsight.
And you don't know it.
In hindsight.
This was a prayer that I'm so glad was unanswered. Oh, Lord.
So this took place 30 years after the original Woodstock, 100 miles away from the original site.
Yes.
And ironically, it was the original Woodstock was an anti-war, peace, love, you know, anti-Vietnam.
Right.
And
94 was a nostalgia.
94 was a nostalgia to it, but with this one, they used the Air Force Base as the venue.
Yes.
Nothing but concrete.
Yes. So I also want everybody to know that if you are a younger listener, which if you are, it is so cool that you're here because a lot of people, you know, would. I really think that this parallels Fyre Festival so much.
Yes.
Except you do not have Andy King getting people Evian. That might have made it.
Oh, a little on the nose.
Well, you know, maybe if somebody was there taking it for the team,
it wouldn't have ended
it
up.
Wouldn't have gone down how the horrible words. Okay.
I think I've got wording. I think I've got my quotes for the Instagram page.
Okay, so here's the thing. All right, so we're not at the original site of 69. We're not at the site for 94. We're now going 100 miles even north. Right?
No, this is 100 miles north of the original site.
So I know, but
50
still,
miles south of the second site.
Right. So we are at the retired Griffiths Air Force Base. Okay. It was Woodstock in name only, basically, and cool art posters. That was pretty much it. And the fact that they had vendors selling hippie crap at
exorbitant prices.
Okay. It's prices that in today's money we would go, really? But then it was like,
it was like, what, $300 a ticket?
Something like that. Yeah.
I don't have it written down.
No. Okay. So MTV had exclusive coverage in the U.S. This took place over 4 days. All right. So
it was a 4 day festival.
Right. And they had a pay per view of the event for fans who could not get tickets.
And then highlights of, you know, the pay per view would be. You watch the whole thing.
Right.
And the MTV would show you maybe half of a song.
Right. Yeah. I was with the free folks because I was broke.
Yeah.
So, all right.
So
this festival was a...
Before we talk about it, this comes with a trigger warning.
Oh, yes. Guys, stop. If you have any triggers of violence, be it of the physical kind, the sexual kind, the whatever... we love you, and we're going to catch you next episode.
Oh, you can just skip ahead.
You can, and in the show notes, we'll put the timestamps.
I will do my best to remember.
You will put the timestamps, because it's a trigger warning, and this is important. Take your pen, make a note.
Okay.
Look, I can tell you right now, my ADD is acting up, his is too. If mine is, his is, and we'll forget. Unintentionally. Make a thing. Okay, cool. Now... Whew. All right. The festival was a complete show from the beginning.
Yeah.
All right. So the only place to get food and drink was from the official vendors who marked up their prices.
Oh, yeah.
When I say marked up, now keep in mind, I'm not talking in today's money. I'm talking in 94 money.
99 money.
99 money. Excuse me. Water, bottled water... was like $12 for a 12-ounce bottle.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even the good stuff. It was not Evian.
No.
There were free water fountains. Right? There were free water fountains that were good for about the first hour.
Yeah, because...
Right. After that, you had... they had thousands of people, a very limited amount of potties, toilets. It was not mud that they were wrestling in. At 99.
It was, and they contaminated the water.
Yes.
Let's be honest. It was water.
Yes.
There
was fecal matter in the water. After like the first day, it was done. Most of the crowd were rowdy. It was basically a bro fest. And the issue is that the girls, after the first day, were like, I'm out.
Yeah.
Deuces. And so all you had were either people who were stuck,
all the jokes.
Bros, or, you know, people who they were trying to be, you know, optimistic, but no.
Because here's the thing, the acts that they booked were liked by both men and women.
Yes.
Heavily liked. And in fact, in some cases, it was more, you know,
right.
well, the women loved the act more than the guys did.
Sometimes. Yeah.
Some of the acts. So it wasn't like they booked all these bro bands.
Right.
It's just more bros got tickets.
Right.
And they did the bro thing.
Yeah. I mean, the crowd was so out of hand that many female attendees stated that there were a large amount of sexual harassment and towards them.
Now, this is 1999 sexual harassment. I know we keep saying, well, this is 1999, but you'd have to...
You had to really
recognize it.
Yes.
It in 99.
Yeah, because back in 99, we still laughed that off as boys being boys. Yeah. Like, you would have to take it really far. I mean, we're talking about girls who were crowd surfing and getting molested while being tossed around. You're talking about rapes, fights, looting, vandalism. Yeah. The bands who were scheduled to perform were some of the biggest acts of the day. You had Limp Bizkit, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Metallica, Kid Rock, Creed, Bush. Korn were the crowd favorite going into the show.
Yeah, they should have headlined. They didn't. They were the semi-main event.
Yeah. And then Bush took the slot, took the headline slot.
I felt so, listening to that documentary, I felt so sorry
for Gavin Rossdale. Oof.
Because he knew.
If he didn't calm them down, it was going
to
be bad.
I not just didn't calm them down, he had to nail his set.
Or they were going to get.
They were going to riot.
Yeah. So, and then. The crowd was so out of control during the Limp Bizkit set, the sound engineers had to bail from the tower, fearful of their safety.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I've done sound engineering at drunken shows and churches.
Yeah.
And I've never once felt
you were
afraid.
About to get put on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even when guys would aggressively show up with a bottle of beer demanding that, the band that I'm working for play this song.
It was never that bad.
Yeah, never that bad. Chili Peppers headlined the festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the minute that John Frusciante and Flea put down their instruments, the riot began.
Yeah, everything was tore down, burned, everything.
Because what happened was they expected a big surprise at the end of day three.
And there was none.
There wasn't. It was, for lack of a better term, it was Hollow Hendrix.
Yeah.
And they gave everybody fireworks.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It was fireworks. No, candles.
Candles. Yeah. They gave everybody candles because it was supposed to be...
Symbolic.
Symbolic in this peace, love, and we're going to meditate, and we're going to wave our candle in the air. No. These are people who... There was no water, so they were living off of whiskey, vodka, and beer.
Yeah.
There was no food... because if you were still there at the last day, either the food had gone kind of funky or it was so overpriced you were broke.
Yeah.
Because while it was like, we're talking like $30 burgers.
Yeah.
Like burger plates. I mean, like burger fries, a drink, whatever, $30. Yeah. But in 99 money, that might as well have been $100.
Yeah, because here's the thing, right? You could buy a Big Mac, fries, and a drink for like $3 at McDonald's at that point.
Gas was 99 cents in the U.S.
and they're
gallon.
Charging $30 for a cheeseburger at a music festival.
Yeah. So Willie Nelson was actually booked to perform on the final day, Sunday, and open the day's music, as the organizers wanted something wholesome to open the final day.
Yeah, they kind of wanted it to be, they said later they wanted to be almost like going to church. And Willie Nelson performing Amazing Grace and stuff like that, kind of mellow everybody out after the second day.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, but it was still, no. It did not go well. Things got set on fire. There were riots. If I'm not mistaken, it wasn't the second night that in the music tent, in the dance tent, Fatboy Slim left.
Yeah.
Because a van crashed into the tent, and in the van was a girl who had been assaulted, laying in the back.
Passed out.
So, women were getting roofied. It was bad. So, it is considered one of the most tone deaf replications of the Woodstock Festival.
Because there have been other things that have tried to piggyback off of Woodstock.
Yeah, but there will never be another Woodstock.
I mean, an official Woodstock, no. I mean, the organizers were more worried about making money than they were about the safety of the crowd. And I mean, even in the interviews that they were doing for MTV, like after the Brick stuff, they were all oblivious to it. You know, it was like the Fyre Festival in the sense that don't tell me anything negative, only tell me something positive.
All right. Yeah, it just, you know. There's a documentary on Netflix called Trainwreck, Woodstock 99.
Which you have to watch it.
Yes.
If you were a fan of 90s music, you have to watch it.
Yes.
So.
And this brings us to our final gig festival.
Yes. And we're going to be talking about Coachella in 1999. So, what happened was, right, in 1993, Pearl Jam played at the Empire Polo Club in Indigo, California.
Yes.
The venue was seen by promoters as the venue for large-scale events at the Polo Club.
Mm-hmm.
Polo Club was considered the next big...
Big place. Yeah.
Yes, I couldn't remember the name of it. Thank you for helping me with that.
Anytime.
After years of trying to book the big acts to the Polo Club, Paul Tollett...
Mm-hmm.
I think I pronounced that right, conceded that a festival would be a great way to book bands and make money. Basically, they've been getting their asses handed to them financially. They needed to make money. Festival would do the job.
Right.
So they began playing in 1998. And how they did that was they went to Glastonbury in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And started showing, you know.
They started handing out flyers.
Yeah. For sunny California. As opposed to the wet and dreary Glastonbury, which it usually is in that time of year.
Right.
You know, they announced, they got the lineup, they got the permits, they got everything, and then Woodstock 99 happened.
Oops.
And a week after Woodstock 99, it's like, hey, we're launching a new festival.
Hmm.
Come to it.
So for those who weren't injured or arrested or traumatized...
Let's do it all again.
Yeah.
But because this was in California and the acts that they announced, you know, they had Beck, Tool, they'd have Rage Against the Machine,
mm-hmm.
Chemical Brothers, Morrissey, Perfect Circle.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to model this festival after the European festivals. So smaller crowds.
Right.
More about the music than anything else. And the festival took place between October 9th and 10th in 1999.
Right.
A massive attack would have been the third night headliner.
Okay.
So, tickets,
mm-hmm.
$50 for a day.
That's not horrible.
It's not horrible. Mm-mm. Especially now considering it's like $2,000 a ticket for Coachella.
Yeah.
You know. And they sold about 37,000 tickets. So...
That helped them not have their asses handed to them
financially. No, that now... Every ticket came with a free bottle of water.
Because
the excess heat out in California in October. And you know what? This, for a first-time festival,
right.
went smooth as a die.
Okay.
There were no arrests. Everybody was well-behaved. The banners were not PG, but not offensive. You know, it was a nice music festival with some real, real great music.
But this first one, didn't they technically lose money? Because they were expecting...
They were expecting double the people to turn up.
Yeah. But you got to remember, a lot of people had a bad taste in their mouth just from what had happened.
In Woodstock. A couple of months before, yeah.
Yeah. So they lost close to $850,000.
And this is why we're including this year, because it was the first one.
Right.
It was influential.
Right.
Would there have been a second one if the bands had decided, pay me my money now?
No.
No. It would have bankrupted the company that did mm-hmm. that. The festival was a major success, and Coachella is probably the biggest music festival in the United States now. Mm-hmm. The second most demanded ticket in the music world.
Wow.
And I mean, the headline and acts over the years have been Who's Who, Who's Anybody, you know, mm-hmm. ranging headliners from Katy Perry to Blur.
Right.
You know, so nice one to end up on. Nice, smooth.
Positive note.
Positive note.
Yes.
Yes. Sarah, what was your favorite music festival, a large, big gig of the 90s?
Oh, it would actually have to be one that not listed here.
Okay.
And I think we might have to do a part two on this for traveling music festivals, which were a thing in the 90s. Yes,
especially over here.
Yes. So my favorite would have been Lilith Fair.
Okay.
And Lollapalooza. So, and that was a touring one.
Yeah.
So, but out of these, I would say that Nebworth
Yeah.
Or 94, Woodstock 94.
Okay.
Those would have been my...
Mine probably would have been Nebworth and the Freddie Mercury Show. Out of these ones that we've got listed here. Yes. I was going to talk about Glastonbury 96, but I don't think there was a Glastonbury 96, so I skipped that one.
I gotcha.
But tell us.
Yes.
We've told you about 9.
Yes.
11, technically, with Sarah's mention of a couple of other ones that I didn't write down. Tell us some of your favorite festivals. Tell some of the favorite gigs that you went to that were seen as important for either the band or the music scene as a whole. Let us know. I'll put that as the question this week, and you can let us know on our social media pages.
Fabulous.
Yes, they're going to be getting a makeover very soon. The website got a makeover. Now the social media page has got to get a makeover.
Yes.
Sarah, it's been great to have you on.
Thank you. It has been awesome being here.
I'll be back here in a couple of minutes as we talk about what's coming up this week on the Because We Network YouTube channel and what's coming up next week in the podcast. So I'll be back in a couple of minutes. Sarah, see you soon.
Bye.
Sincere thank you once again for Sarah for coming on, and it was important to have her on this week to get her perspective on some of these gigs and festivals, some that she would really like to have gone to and some that she almost went to. It would have been a disaster if she'd made it to Woodstock 99, let me tell you. But it was great to have her on, great to get a perspective. What is your favorite big gig of the 90s? Now, by big gig, I mean like huge attendance or important festival, you know, important... it's something that defines the generation, that defines a band, that defines a group of bands. Okay, what's yours? Let us know on our social media pages. You can find them in the description below in our link tree. And that's Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And there will be a question about that later on in the week. Moving on to that, the 90s Gamer, Dog Ate My Homework series, continues next week, part 13. I'm not sure how many more parts there are going to be. I'm going to keep promoting until we run out of Pokemon to do. But we're steadily moving along. Where I am right now, we're actually, as I'm recording, we are part 8. So, yeah, part 7, excuse me. So that's, you know, we're a couple of weeks ahead. I don't know exactly how many more weeks we're going to get out of this. But I know for a fact we'll have a 13th episode, judging by my pace in which I'm going so far. Now, I mentioned that next week's podcast, Sarah will be back. We'll be talking about Red Hot Chili Peppers' masterpiece, Californication. I think that was a great album, and I'm looking forward to explaining why and some of the inspirational stories behind that, even if some of the tracks are a little icky today. And I'll explain that next week. You'll know which one I'm talking about when I start talking about it. If I start talking about it, even. But that is going to be it for this week, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I hope the episode wasn't too... too hazardous for most people. I know that the Woodstock 99 conversation got heavy, but I'm happy with how the rest of this stuff turned out. So if you have any gig and festival, let us know on our social media pages on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Go check out becausewenetwork.com for the latest archives. Yes, everything that we've ever done ever is going to be archived in there. I've been working on ways to make the site work better, so it's been going through a design redo, and so far it's looking good. I've got to do the podcast one the next couple of days. It's not a problem at all. But with that in mind, I want to thank everybody who has taken the time to listen to us, and thank you all for listening today. We will see you next Sunday. Hopefully you'll join us for our Dog Ate My Homework stream for appetizer before we get started. And that's it for this week. I want you to take it easy, everybody. Say your prayers. Take your vitamins. Be good. Be nice to people. Doesn't cost anything to be nice to people. If they're mean to you, then just ignore them. You know, all that stuff. and we will be back next week. Take it easy, everybody. Bye.
Okay, we're good. Hello. Okay. It's Bree.